Well, we're about halfway through the tour of the cell, but we're in the part where we can go through the slides a little quicker, because we've already talked about these things, really. Slide 12 just gives you a closer-up view of the central vacuole in cartoon form, but when you look at the photomicrograph, you can see what I was saying. This takes up quite a bit of the volume of the cell, which is why plants can grow more quickly than animals. But no new information, just a close-up picture. 13 really isn't new information either, but it gives you finally a good picture to accompany what I've already told you about the fact that membrane material is continuously moving around from organelle to organelle. So we see that right here as a piece of membrane that is currently part of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is budding off so that it can become a vesicle to contain these purple spheres that represent the now modified polypeptides that have been modified by the rough ER. That's its job. And so the vesicle that's forming is going to coalesce or fuse with the membrane that makes up the nearby Golgi, and specifically the cis face of the Golgi, which is the receiving part of the whole organelle. Since it's the same stuff, membrane material, it will just coalesce, kind of like oil droplets coalescing into a bigger droplet, and that will spill the contents of that vesicle into the lumen of the Golgi, so that the Golgi, having received the package, can figure out where those specific polypeptides, whatever they are, need to go. That's the job of the Golgi. Receive it, figure out where it needs to go, and then ship it properly. And it ships it by forming a new vesicle from the trans face of the Golgi complex that now contains the, a collection of the same kinds of polypeptides that need to go somewhere. But you can see this specifically happening in such a way that these purple proteins, whatever they are destined to be fully exported from the cell. They're not going to be part of the cell anymore. They're going to have to be built inside the cell, because proteins have to be built inside cells to begin with. But these ones are going to be spilled outward. And so that this vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, which is also the same material. And therefore, a membrane here is moving from organelle to the plasma membrane, and it can then be taken back up later by the plasma membrane and recycled over and over. But notice that when the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, it will just open up and spill those modified proteins to the extracellular fluid, where those particular kinds of proteins need to operate. 14. Much better view of a mitochondrion. What do you know about a mitochondrion already? Nothing? Yeah.
It's membrane bound.
It is a membrane bounded organelle.
Double membrane.
It is doubly membrane bounded, right? And what is its job?
Cellular respiration.
Correct. Cellular respiration, which we'll study the details of in Unit 3 after this upcoming test. As far as anatomy is concerned, though, what we're looking at here is the fact that although it is doubly membrane bounded, there are two separate mitochondrial membranes for each mitochondrion, and they're called the outer membrane and the inner membrane. Although that's true, the outer membrane is actually smaller than the inner membrane. The outer membrane is just as big as it needs to be a smooth covering, as you see here. But the inner membrane is made of a lot more membrane material, and that's because it folds back and forth many times. Each of these major folds that we see is called a crista, the plural of which is Christi. And why would you have these folds? Exactly. Just like microvilli increase surface area by folding plasma membrane back and forth, these Christi in a mitochondrion drastically increase the surface area of that inner mitochondrial membrane. And the reason that makes sense evolutionarily is that, as we'll see when we look at the details of cellular respiration, having that process work requires a bunch of proteins that are embedded in the membrane. Therefore, more membrane means more proteins can be embedded, and you can get the process done even more efficiently, the process of cellular respiration. You also see ribosomes inside the mitochondrion. This is kind of interesting because the mitochondrion evolved from prokaryotes. This is part of what is called the endosymbiotic theory. To explain the origin of some organelles, including mitochondria. What the endosymbiotic theory says is that you had originally an early eukaryotic cell in the early history of eukaryotes that was busy doing its job of going around and engulfing cells, mostly bacteria, as food. And when they were engulfed, they would be digested just like we digest food that we eat and used for energy. That, of course, would kill the bacteria that are being engulfed. But for whatever reason, one of these cells did this, and the bacterium survived being engulfed and remained living inside the eukaryotic cell. Well, not only was this a bacterium that got engulfed, but it happened to be a bacterium capable of cellular respiration. I think last time I told you that cellular respiration was invented by bacteria, just like photosynthesis was, before there were any eukaryotic cells. And so this surviving cellular respiration capable bacterium became the first mitochondrion. And this is why it makes sense that it has two membranes. The inner membrane is the membrane of that bacterium. The outer membrane comes from the fact that this came in as a vesicle. So it's part of the plasma membrane of the cell that engulfed it. Okay? And there are two membranes now. That's fairly compelling evidence just right there. But there's much more compelling evidence, including the fact that a mitochondrion has not only its own ribosomes that are separate from the ribosomes of the main cell, but those ribosomes are structurally, molecularly, like bacterial ribosomes, and they're different molecularly from the main ribosomes in the cytoplasm of the same cell. Also, mitochondria have their own DNA, separate from the nuclear DNA that's in the cell. And that DNA is circular, a circular chromosome just like bacterial DNA. Yeah.
Quick fun thing. So because of that DNA, for that separate DNA, you can technically have three parents.
Yes. And this also explains why we talk about the so-called mitochondrial Eve when we try to trace human history, for instance.
Yeah.
And the reason it's Eve, a woman, is because the female is the member of the species that donates the bigger gamete. Sperm just inject their DNA. The egg is the rest of the cell, which includes the mitochondria. And so you can trace it back DNA-wise for that reason to a woman early on in the speciation that led to humans. And another bit of evidence, by the way, is that just like bacteria, free-living bacteria, mitochondria are able to divide into two new mitochondria. They reproduce within the cell, in other words. By the way, also anatomically, since this is a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, that means that there is subcompartmentalization within it. It's already not not even a whole cell, right? It's just an organelle. But you have two compartments within the mitochondrion. There's the compartment that's between the two membranes, which is descriptively called the intermembrane space, the space between the membranes. And that's its own aqueous solution. And then you have the chamber that's inside the inner membrane, and that's called the mitochondrial matrix, which is also an aqueous solution, but it's chemically different from the aqueous solution that occupies the intermembrane space. All right, we'll have much more to say about mitochondria in a different unit. Slide 15 is a close-up of a chloroplast. What's the major job of the chloroplast?
Photosynthesis,
which is why you find these only in producers, not in us consumers. All animals are consumers. Well, it's also a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, and it also came into existence evolutionarily endosymbiotically. So everything that I just said about the mitochondrion is also true, but separately, in a separate event, for chloroplasts. So we are the descendants of cells that engulfed bacteria to make the first mitochondria, and that's why we have mitochondria, but not chloroplasts. Some of those cells that had already attained mitochondria endosymbiotically then engulfed for food a photosynthetic bacterium that happened to survive that process and became the first chloroplast. And so this gave rise to the first eukaryotic cells that became photosynthetic, which are the ancestors to plants and algae, the photosynthetic eukaryotes. And that explains why they have both chloroplasts and mitochondria, whereas we have just mitochondria. The membrane situation is kind of depends on who you ask, really. There's three different membranes that are named, even though technically it's two membranes, if you ask me. There's the so-called outer membrane and the so-called inner membrane, which are shown here. But the inner membrane is actually continuous with the third membrane that's named here, which is the thylakoid membrane, which is all the green membrane here. The inner membrane actually is continuous with, just like the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope is continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum. You don't really see it in this figure, but this inner membrane becomes all of this elaborate green stuff. So it's technically only two membranes, but we consider it to be three as far as naming it is concerned. The thylakoid membrane is very elaborately folded, as you see here, into these structures that look like separate structures, but they're all connected when you look at them in cutaway view. But it looks like it's a bunch of coin-like structures in stacks. Each individual coin-like structure is a thylakoid. And one stack of thylakoids is called a granum, the plural of which is grana, G-R-A-N-A. And there are several grana within one chloroplast. So we also have different compartments in this. There is an intermembrane space here as well, because that's between the outer and inner membranes. There is the space, the compartment that's inside the inner membrane but outside of the thylakoids, and that's called the stroma. And then there's the compartment that's inside all of these thylakoids, which are connected to each other, and that's called the thylakoid space. But we'll talk about how photosynthesis works in Unit 3 as well. Brings us to 16. Just a photomicrograph here. There's no new information. It just demonstrates that we don't just draw these cartoons of chloroplasts, for instance, just out of imagination. It's based on real data. You can see that a chloroplast actually does have these stacks. This is a granum of thylakoids right here. 17, we haven't said much about the cytoskeleton other than that's the name. And how many kinds of proteins make up the cytoskeleton, major categories of proteins? Three, exactly. And two of them are shown here, microfilaments and microtubules. What's the one that's not labeled here? Well, microfilaments, meaning small filaments, of course, are, of the three, the smallest diameter filaments. Yes, microtubules are the widest ones, and the third one was therefore named intermediate filaments because they are bigger in diameter than the microfilaments, but not as big in diameter as the microtubules. They do different jobs, though. It's not just only about their size. Microtubules, I think I told you last time, serve as roadways. Just like a city requires roads for the vehicles to get from place to place, carrying things from place to place, like trucks, for instance. These microtubules are roadways within the cell, along which special proteins called motor proteins act like little trucks, carrying things from one place in the cell to another. And they're called microtubules because they're hollow. Let's take a look. Actually, the next slide should be a comparison of the three. Oh, actually, no. Slide 18 is what I was just talking about. These motor proteins are proteins, as the phrase indicates. And this is not just a cartoon either. It looks like a little person walk with two legs walking along this yellow microtubule. Microtubules are hollow, as you see. They're made of monomers, but when you put the monomers together, it forms a tube-like structure. Anyway, the motor protein has actually two legs that walk one step at a time. They attach, and then the other leg detaches and attaches farther up. So it's exactly like walking one step at a time. And you can see real motor proteins right here walking along this microtubule. And the motor protein has cargo. It's carrying something. The vesicle contains something that needs to be moved from one place in the cell to another along these microtubules. And that's an expensive process, as you should guess, because things don't move for free, right? Just like you have to put fuel in the truck. Well, ATP is the source of energy. It requires a fresh ATP molecule for every single step along the way. So that's a major job of one of the three kinds of cytoskeletal elements. Slide 19 is a comparison of all three. We just talked about microtubules, and you can see here that when you compare them that they are the widest in diameter. The thinnest are the microfilaments in the middle. And the microfilaments are made chiefly of two kinds of proteins, actin and myosin. But here, actin is shown. These are mainly involved in movements of some sort. They can cause deformation of the cell to change its shape, which is what happens in a muscle. Your muscle, skeletal muscles, have a bunch of actins and myosins that are two kinds of proteins that interact with each other. They're filaments, both of them, and they don't change their length. Now, the muscle gets shorter, but not because the actin and myosin get shorter. Instead, it's because the actin and myosin overlap more and more, and that causes the whole muscle to get shorter. But it's more than just skeletal muscles or cardiac muscles or smooth muscles that do this. It's other kinds of cells can do this as well, changing the shape of the cell, for instance. And then intermediate filaments are more like ropes or cables. They're there for structural strength, to hold things in place, to anchor things, and to provide strain relief. When things get pulled, they withstand that tensile force without breaking the cell. You can see their keratin is involved, which is a prevalent animal protein. Slide 20 is just a close-up of a centrosome. Remember that the centrosome is not the T-shaped thing. The T-shaped thing is made of two centrioles that occur in the centrosomes of animal cells, but not in the centrosomes of other eukaryotes. And like I said, we really haven't figured out what they do, but they are there in animal centrosomes. The centrosome is the yellow halo that you see here. It's a microtubule organizing center. And that's why microtubules that are part of the cytoskeleton are seen growing from the centrosome. And a cell starts out with one centrosome, but it eventually has two, because a major function of the centrosomes, when there are two, are to form what is called the mitotic spindle that we'll study later, that is important in splitting the nucleus into two as part of cell division in a eukaryote. We've talked about flagella. Remember I said that they are locomotory devices if they are present on a cell, which is not every cell. But we talked about sperm as a good example of a flagellated animal cell. They are long, kind of whip-like structures, long compared to the rest of the cell. And they, by the flagellum moving, it pushes on the surroundings, on the liquid medium in which the cell lives, just like a propeller of a boat pushes on the liquid medium in which the boat is, and that propels the thing forward. So locomotory flagella are all about getting a cell through the medium from point A to point B. On the bottom, we see much smaller structures, cilia. That's a plural of cilium. Cilium means hair. Now, these are not truly hair. The real hair is made by mammals only. But they're hair-like in appearance. That's why we give them the name. And they are microscopic projections from the surface of the cell in some cells. Not all cells are ciliated, just like not all cells are flagellated. Well, cilia can also be used as locomotory devices. And that's true if you have a free-living cell, like a unicellular organism, for instance. Some unicellular organisms are ciliated, and you'll see them under a microscope with their cilia beating back and forth. A big difference between cilia and flagella, other than the size, cilia are much smaller, is that if a cell is ciliated, it typically features many cilia over possibly the entire surface of the cell, whereas a flagellated cell will have one or a small number of flagella on just one specific end of the cell. But cilia beat back and forth in a coordinated manner, and in a free-living cell, it's not attached to anything, it's just in the fluid. The beating of the cilia can also propel the cell from point A to point B. Not quite as directly, it's kind of like a tumbling motion, but it gets the cell through the medium, so it has the same purpose as a flagellum. But in a cell that is not free living, but is connected to a surface, the beating of cilia can serve the purpose of moving the fluid past the cell, rather than moving the cell through the medium. A good example in your body would be the epithelial cells that line your trachea, your windpipe, leading to your lungs. Those cells are mucus, for one thing. By the way, the adjective mucus is spelled O-U-S. The noun, the stuff, is also pronounced mucus, but it's M-U-C-U-S. Mucus, as an adjective, means producing or having to do with mucus, the stuff. So these are mucus cells, producing mucus, in other words, that are also ciliated. And the reason that they're mucus is because as you inhale air, you're really trying to get just the gas, right, the oxygen that's part of the air. But you can't help inhaling with it a bunch of debris, solid particles of soot or whatever, cigarette smoke if you're foolish enough to smoke, with all kinds of trash that we're breathing in, that stuff, and bacteria as well, because there's things living in the air, that stuff, which is heavier than the molecules of gas, tends to stick to the mucus. So that's why the mucus is in place, to trap it so that it doesn't get down into the alveoli of the lungs and compromise the function of the lungs. Well, that holds them in place. But the cilia that are beating continuously then move this carpet of mucus with all the debris caught in it upward to your throat. And that's why periodically throughout the day, or intermittently throughout the day, you swallow, which then puts this stuff into your stomach. The best place to put things that could contain harmful pathogens, because your stomach is the least hospitable place on your body to other organisms because of that low pH. It's very acidic in your stomach. Most pathogens can't survive that pH change, so that kills them. But that's, notice that use of cilia, because these cells are in place, is used not to propel the cell through the medium, but to propel the medium past the cell. Chapter 22 shows you the molecular architecture involved in a cilium. This is one cilium in cartoon form, but it matches the real micrograph. You can see that there's a bunch of microtubules, just like we've already talked about. These microtubules are the same kind as the ones that form roadways. But there's a bunch of them bundled together in one cilium, and there's also a bunch of motor proteins, just like the ones I talked about, that move things from place to place within the cell, each with two legs that walk along. But by having them in this arrangement, notice that the things that the motor proteins are carrying, and they're all sharing one load here, the cargo is another microtubule. So an army of motor proteins are walking along one microtubule, all sharing, carrying another microtubule.
Those microtubules are carrying other motor proteins.
Well, they're connected to other motor proteins, yes. Now, in the next slide, we can see how this causes the bending motion, if you don't understand just by looking at the pictures, you can imagine with a couple pieces of paper. If these pieces of paper are the two microtubules, and you have motor proteins walking along one, carrying the other, if they're not tethered together, then you would just see this, right? They would slip past each other. But they are tethered by still another kind of protein, these blue things. The two microtubules are tethered so that they can't indefinitely slip past each other. Therefore, it's like a bent piece of paper. That's the tethering, right? Now you have the two microtubules that are connected together, but if you try to walk these, notice that it bends instead. And that's how cilia beat back and forth, at the expense of ATP for energy, of course. 24. Close-up of microvilli, those are the things that drastically increase the surface area that I was talking about. And inside of those, you find cytoskeletal elements. There are actin filaments in here, which are then in turn connected to intermediate filaments that are part of the cytoskeleton of the general skeleton, of the general cell compartment. This is part of strain relief I was talking about. If something tugs on these, they're held in place by the fact that they're connected to these intermediate filaments. 25 shows you the action of actin microfilaments. Those are the ones that I said are involved in movements of various sorts, like in your muscles. A skeletal muscle cell is an end-to-end arrangement of what are called sarcomeres. You see one sarcomere here, a boundary here, and a boundary here. But a sarcomere is like train car in a train. A train is an end-to-end arrangement of many cars, right? A sarcomere is like one car in the train. And within that you have actin and myosin microfilaments that stay the same length, but in response to the stimulus from the neuron, they overlap more. And notice when I overlap my fingers, my thumbs move together, just like the boundaries of the sarcomere move together. So each car in the train gets shorter at the same time, and therefore the overall train gets much shorter all at once. And that's how muscles contract and pull on bones to allow you to make your movements. But the same things are involved in this so-called amoeboid movement, which is really just a deformation, a change in shape of the cell. This is how some unicellular organisms that we collectively call amoebas, that's not an actual species, that's just a category of cells that move around in this way. They stick out a portion of their cell by deforming it, called a pseudopode, a false foot, and that sticks to something, and then they drag the rest of it along, and then they keep doing that over and over. They just crawl along, basically. And you can witness what we see on the bottom, which also involves actin. This is called cyclosis, when you put a plant cell under a light microscope. The plant will rearrange the positioning of its chloroplasts using these actin filaments, because it's trying to get the chloroplasts, which are what collect the sunlight in order to conduct photosynthesis, to where the light is. And a light microscope has light shining on those cells, so you can witness this if it's still a living cell. You can see the cyclosis, or the movement around the vacuole of the chloroplasts. 26. Well, this isn't any new information either. We've already talked about all of these parts, but it gives you, in the photomicrograph, a good, real, photographic evidence of the fact that cell walls are much thicker than plasma membrane. This is just the flimsy plasma membrane right here, just the lining. This thickness is the cell wall, and that's why they don't burst in the case of... Well, what tenacity do plants prefer?
Hypotonicity,
exactly. That's what's going to always bring water into the cell by osmosis, right? Because water always goes to where it's less watery. Cell walls built to withstand that pressure. 27. This is an even better view of the strain relief function I was talking about for cytoskeletal elements. So you have stuff that's outside of the cell here, which includes not only water, of course, the blue background, but also a bunch of macromolecules, including these purple proteins. Well, the proteins came from where? They came from cells. They're not in cells right now, but they can't be built outside of cells. That requires mRNA and ribosomes interacting. So proteins are built inside of cells, even proteins that need to then, after being built, be exported to the exterior. So these were built inside cells somewhere, but now they're part of the extracellular matrix. And these purple proteins that are part of the membrane are also proteins. These are examples of membrane-bound proteins, right? Not membrane-bounded. These are proteins that are tied to and part of the membrane, so they are membrane-bound proteins. And then you have proteins that are fully inside the cell that are part of the cytoskeleton, right? These are the intermediate microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. Well, if something, notice they're all connected to each other. If something pulls on these extracellular proteins, that's going to pull on the proteins in the plasma membrane, which is pretty flimsy, right? So you would easily be able to pull these proteins out of the membrane, which would be bad. But on the other side, the intracellular side of the same protein, it's connected to still other proteins that are part of the cytoskeleton. So when you pull here, it pulls through this protein onto this tough network of fibers. And therefore, it doesn't rupture the plasma membrane and kill the cell. That's what I meant by strain relief. No new information in 28 either. It's just a photomicrograph of plasmodesmata. We've already talked about them, but they are real things. It's not just cartoon tunnels. You can see them passing from one cell to another, which is why a plant, which can be a huge thing, is really has one common cytoplasm in however many cells it has, because the cytoplasm is continuous from one plant cell to another through these tunnel-like plasmodesmata. Now, plasmodesmata are intercellular junctions that we find between plant cells, but animals also have intercellular junctions, just with different names. That's what we're looking at in slide 29. Let's orient ourselves. We're looking at the interior of just one cell, which is packed together with a bunch of cells next to it. Right? So before the cutaway, this would have been a complete cell. We're looking at the inside of it. And there are a few major categories of intercellular junctions that you need to know for this course. Let's start with desmosomes. And you see several different desmosomes here. A desmosome is a complex of proteins, membrane-bound proteins. But a desmosome, and it gets its name, by the way, because desmos means tree. It's kind of like a tree-like structure, or more of a bush, really, in this picture. But anyway, a desmosome, functionally speaking, is an intercellular junction between animal cells that serves the purpose of holding those cells together. A desmosome is more or less doing the same thing that a spot weld is doing between two pieces of sheet metal. You know what I mean by a spot weld? It's how a fender or a quarter panel on a car is made rigid. The two pieces of metal are not welded together at every place they meet. They're just spot welded here and there. And those spot welds hold the whole thing together. Same thing here. It's not a complete bond. Just you have a desmosome here and there holding the cells together. So this is especially important in an epithelium, which is a type of tissue in animals made up of a bunch of cells packed tightly together. Like the epidermis of your skin, for instance, is an epithelium. They are structural proteins, therefore. They maintain structural integrity of the epithelium. Gap junctions are shown below the desmosome. And what do those look like to you? That we've already discussed. Yeah. What intercellular junctions do they look like? Well, microtubules aren't intercellular junctions. What intercellular junctions did we just already talk about? Plasmodesmata, right. Gap junctions look just like plasmodesmata, except you find gap junctions in between certain animal cells. They are the animal version, in other words, of plasmodesmata. But they serve the same function, more or less. In other words, they are complexes of proteins that form tunnels, allowing certain kinds of particles, they have to be the right kinds of particles, to pass from one cell to the next in an animal. So just like plasmodesmata allow for intercellular communication in plants, gap junctions allow for intercellular communication in animals. A good example in your body is found in your heart muscle. In order to operate efficiently as a pump, your heart, the individual muscles of your heart chambers need to contract as simultaneously as possible. Right? You want them to be synchronized so that the whole atrium gets small at the same time to force the blood into the ventricles, and then the whole ventricle gets small at the same time to force it out of the aorta onto the rest of the body. To do that, you need the signals that cause the contractions to be efficiently spread from one cell to another. And you have gap junctions between individual cardiac muscle cells that allow the flow of ions to go through there. And ions carry charge, so that's electrical charge that is being distributed, and that's what causes the contraction of the heart muscles. The top one is a tight junction. And this is a really big complex of proteins. Remember, we're looking at the inside of the cell. If this were a complete cell, this tight junction would be like a band of tape going all the way around the edge of the cell. And more specifically, it's like double-sided tape, because this band of tape is around this one cell, but it's also connecting all the cells around it to that one cell. Okay? Tight junctions do hold cells together, but that's not actually their main function, because that function is already being taken care of by the stronger desmosomes. So tight junctions aren't really about structural integrity. Instead, they are about forming seals. So up to now, in this course, when I've used the word membrane, I've been talking about subcellular membranes, membranes that are smaller than the cell itself, right? The phospholipid bilayer. That's what I've been talking about when I talk about membrane material, whether it's plasma membrane or part of a membrane-bounded organelle. That's a microscopic membrane. But there are also multicellular membranes, like your skin, for instance, or the epidermis of your skin. That's a macroscopic membrane, much bigger than the membrane of a single cell, because that membrane is made up of multiple cells, multiple layers of cells even. All right? So if we talk about a macroscopic membrane, which is a collection of cells, let me just draw a few in a couple layers. A membrane is a lining. A macroscopic membrane is a lining. So your epithelia, which are membranes, cover surfaces. And you have them not only your epidermis externally, but also internal membranes. Anyway, linings form boundaries. And that's true for these macroscopic membranes, epithelial tissue. If you are some sort of particle that would like to get through that macroscopic membrane from here to here, there are two major routes that you could take. You could start by going through the plasma membrane of one cell in that collection. Now you're inside that cell, travel through that cell, go out the other side, enter another cell for however many layers there are of cells, until you're finally on the other side of the overall membrane. That would be called the cellular route that you took, because it involves entering cells. The other major possibility, though, would be to try to fit in the spaces between cells and never actually go into any cell. Just go through the cracks between cells. And that would be called the paracellular route. Para means next to. So if you're going to actually get through the overall membrane, one of these has to be taken. One of these routes has to be taken. Well, a tight junction is there for the purpose of blocking the paracellular route, because this double-sided tape, so to speak, that a tight junction is, will allow this thing to get a certain amount of distance in the crack between two cells, but then it'll come up against the tight junction and be blocked. So that means if that kind of particle is going to get through the overall tissue, it's going to have to go through the cellular route. And that's important because each cell is kind of the boss, to a certain extent, as to what gets through it, because a cell controls its own plasma membrane and can control what actually gets through the membrane. So tight junctions, for instance, are important in waterproofing our epidermis. Looks like I'm done with the chapter, because 30 is one of these typical summary slides that you can look at to study with, but I've mentioned all of this. So that's one recording.